Well, I've got I've got sort of three and a half talks here. Bits, it's all bits and pieces, really. So I don't know quite where I'll go with it. I don't even know quite where to start. Maybe I could start with what Padmavendra mentioned, because I was going to mention this this communication exercise, because it was one of the things that one of the things about the movement that really gripped me. I didn't understand it. Puja gripped me as well, and I didn't understand that either. But with the communication exercises, I thought, there's something in this. There's definitely something in this. And I don't know if I had it with Padmavendra, but because we were in hysterics, weren't we, for about 45 minutes. I've had experiences doing communication exercises where I don't know where I end and the other person begins. And I didn't think much of this in the early days. It just, well, you know, it's just some, you know, funny little psycho thing that Banty's popped into the mix to sort of keep us busy kind of thing. But quite a bit later, more recently actually, I think it was... one of his memoirs or travel letters, where he's talking about leading communication exercises in America for all these students, and he says that this was very successful, and some of the people doing the communication exercises were able to get into states where they were sort of self-transcendent, they were transcending themselves. And I thought, oh, right, yeah, that's why I like it, kind of thing. There's something about it. And there are resonances with this. More recently, about 4 or 5 years ago, I went to France with my girlfriend. We were fiddling around down near Carcassonne and stuff. And we went into this town. I don't know if it was Carcassonne itself. I think it was another town. But they were having a sort of carnival. And there were all these young students dressed in clowns' outfits, wandering around, you know, like playing tricks on members of the public and stuff. And we didn't think much of this. And we sat down in this square, you know, and just sort of watched what was going on. And this young woman, dressed in, you know, clown kits, came and sat down next to me and just looked at me, and I looked at her. But it's like something happened, you know. I got really sort of woo, you know. You know, I'm losing myself, kind of thing. It really was quite a moment. And she just smiled at me, got up and walked away. And it's like, it took me the rest of the day to recover, I think. And then funnily enough, I mean, I'm going to mention dreams a bit later, but I had a dream 2 years ago where I can't remember much about it, except that there was this young blonde woman who was an order member, and we were just looking in each other's eyes. She had a name as well, which is odd. It's not the name of an order member that actually is. And she was blonde. So afterwards I thought, well, that's a bit weird, because I don't usually go for blonde. So there must have been something else going on. But we looked at each other in this dream, and I just felt intense happiness and love. And it stayed with me for a few days. It was quite remarkable. Just this looking and sort of losing myself in this, whoever it was. I don't know who it was. Very, very strange. So anyway, I just thought I'd sort of start with that. What should I do now? I've done those. This is what my talks are like, I'm afraid. Right, here we go. Look, let's do something. Let's talk a bit about knowing, a bit of theory, I suppose, in a way, although you can't have theory with myth and stuff. This is a little poem that I really like, and I call it my Survey of Buddhism poem. I really like this poem. It's by somebody called Rebecca Elson, called Evolution. We are survivors of immeasurable events flung upon some reach of land, Small wet miracles without instructions, only the imperative of change. And this for me is my as I say my survey poem. It really sort of encapsulates for me the survey. All we've got, we don't get instructions. We, you know, we get born, we go to school, they fill us full of crap, and they basically nothing that's really very useful. We don't get any instructions. All we've got is the imperative of change. And very often we resist that. We don't even look at that. We don't want to know about that. It makes us feel insecure and anxious and all the rest of it. So we try and sort of drop it. And we can get into the idea that we know what's going on and that we're actually in control. Super crazy, isn't it? We think we're in control. It's really mad, really mad. I love this little quote from Padmasambhava in The Life and Liberation. Let these three expressions, I do not have, I do not understand, I do not know, be repeated over and over again. That is the heart of my advice. Because we don't know, we don't understand, and we haven't got anything. When we die, it's like it all gets taken away. I don't know if you've ever done anything like that. I went, what was it, 5 years ago, my dad died. And my mother had died 3 years previously. So I had to go to Australia because they lived in Australia. And so I cleared the house out. My brother didn't want to do it for one reason or another. So I cleared the house out. And there was all this stuff that I can remember from when I was a little boy. And he just hadn't chucked anything out. He'd left all my mother's clothes in there. They were all there as if she was still there. It's quite remarkable, quite remarkable. So he just didn't, he thought he could take it with him. I don't think I can take my stuff with me. You're going to have to sort that out when I go.
That's a massive assumption.
It is a massive assumption, yeah. I think Padmavajra quoted this the other day, that Banti says that actually we know nothing. And it's not that we don't know very much. We literally don't know anything about anything. I can't give you the reference for that, I'm afraid. There's an interesting little extract from a book called Life and How to Survive It that I've really sort of latched onto. This book is by John Cleese, the comedian, and his psychotherapist, Robin Skinner. There's a very interesting little book, actually, and there's quite a bit of Buddhism in it. This isn't Buddhism, but it's very apposite. They're having a discussion, and they go into the meaning of the words understand and understanding. And the dialogue goes like this. So Skinner says, remember, what the word really means, to stand under, in the sense of seeing yourself as something much, as part of something much bigger, infinitely more important than you are. So Cleese says, as opposed to, and Skinner says, well, the rest of the time we're fundamentally egocentric. We're attempting to dominate in order to have our own way and fulfill our personal desires, to impose ourselves. Let's call that overstanding. When you're overstanding, you're really only interested in what you're getting in the short run. You're out for your own immediate advantage, because you're not giving validity to other people's interests. And also, you're ignoring most of the consequences of your actions, as if you could somehow control them. That's an interesting little bit that leapt out of me reading it this time, that he mentions the consequences of your actions. So I really like that. And I read this once in a study group, and one of the mitras said, don't stand over and know, stand under and wonder. And I thought, yes, that's good, I like that. So I made a note of it. So we have to, I'm not going to read that bit. Where am I going to next? We just don't know. I'll read you this little poem. I've got poems dotted around all over the place. This is Matthew Arnold, Below the Surfaced Stream. Let's try the other pair. I might get on better with these. Maybe. Below the surface stream. Below the surface stream, shallow and light of what we say we feel. Below the stream, as light of what we think we feel. There flows with noiseless current strong, obscure and deep, the central stream of what we feel indeed. So it's more of, we don't really know what's going on. We don't know ourselves, we don't know other people. Somewhere I've got a quote where it says, if you don't know yourself, you can't know anything else. And I won't bother to find it. It's in here somewhere. This is an interesting little quote as well. I collect axioms and little quotes, I'm afraid. This is J.B. Priestley from a play called Time and the Conways, which I can thoroughly recommend. It's a very interesting play. I won't tell you much about that, but one of the characters in this play says, "Now, at this moment in time, or at any moment, we're only a cross-section of ourselves. What we really are is the whole stretch of ourselves, all our time, when we come to the end of this life. All these selves, all our time, will be us, the real you and the real me." I really like that. So it's like at any one point in our life, we're just a cross-section. But we can think this is it, can't we? And this, we look at the back stuff and we think we know where we're going again. And I like this thing about when we come to the end, we have to consider the end. And again, we don't do this. We think we're going to live forever, don't we? I mean, this does wear off a bit as you get older. By the time you get to my age, the teeth start falling out. You have to put in hearing aids and your eyes get bad. And so you start to think, oh, actually, the old machine's not working as well as it used to. Maybe there is an end after all. So we have to consider this. And another little thing that I've sort of dug up and slipped in here is something called the regrets of the dying. This is a little thing I picked up a couple of years ago, I think. It's written by a palliative care nurse. Just looking at, you know, years and years of looking after people who were dying. And she comes up with these five regrets. And they're almost universal. It's quite interesting. One, I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. This was the most common regret of all. Interesting. I won't go into this. I mean, there's a lot that could be said about this. Two, I wish I didn't work so hard. And this came from every male patient that she nursed. They'd put so much into the treadmill of a work existence that they'd, you know, they weren't in touch with their families, they'd lost touch with their wife, they didn't really engage with their children, and, you know, and they get to 65 and it's like, oh, what was all that about? And then they don't know what to do, and if they're not very careful, they have a heart attack within 6 months and die. So, you know, you have to remember this, yeah? Don't get stuck on the treadmill of a work existence. Three, I wish I'd had the courage to express my feelings. Many people suppress their feelings in order to keep peace with others. Doesn't work. Very, very dangerous. Yeah. Four, I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends. Apparently, when you're dying, you really miss your friends. You start to remember them all. I can remember when my dad was going through this. He just started remembering things from when he was quite young. It all just comes back at the end. Yeah, so don't wait for the end. Five, I wish I'd let myself be happier. Many didn't realise until the end that happiness is a choice. And they found when they were dying, they longed to laugh properly and have silliness in their life. Yeah, so start laughing now. Start being silly now. Yeah, or you'll have regrets when you come to the end of your life. And it is coming, yeah? The end is nigh. Okay. What shall I do now? Okay, let's the words, myth and symbol, yeah? I've got quite a lot to say about this. I mean, well, I think I'll restrict myself to Banti, although he's not the only one who talks about this stuff in this kind of way. Other people have done it as well. Myth. This is me talking about myth. The dictionary is not much use, yeah? Connotations of the supernatural and imaginary. Yeah? Banti's described myth as a symbolic story, a whole story, every detail of which is symbolical or has symbolic meaning. The myth consists of symbols. And now this is Banti talking. This is from the Vimalakirti Nidesha lecture. Now, we're using the word myth rather loosely here, not using it in its literal sense. In fact, it hasn't got a literal sense. The realm of myth is not a realm of clearly defined meanings. That's the whole point about it. The realm of myth is a realm of undefined meanings. Somebody mentioned this the other day, didn't they? Indeed, it's a realm of indefinable meanings. Nowadays, a whole industry has been set up apparently to explain the meaning of all sorts of ancient myths. But these meanings, inverted commas, of ancient myths cannot really be explained in this sort of way. They can't, in fact, be understood in the conceptual sense at all. The meaning, so to speak, of myth, it's interesting, that Banti never says so to speak. It's not a verbal habit. When he puts so to speak in, he's being analogous, yeah? He's treating what he's saying as a symbol. And you have to really, I know when I first started listening to Banti's things, he kept saying so to speak, and you think, oh, that's some sort of verbal tick he's got, but it's not. He never does it when it's not necessary. So, where was I? These meanings of ancient myths cannot. The meaning, so to speak, of myths, has to be felt, has to be experienced, has to be enacted, has to be lived. There are various other things that belong to this realm of undefined meanings, such things as symbols, archetypal images, the imagination itself, poetry, as well as myth. In fact, I'm using the word myth to cover, to suggest, to indicate, to hint at all these things. The word myth, in fact, represents the whole realm of undefined meanings. And this realm I've indicated by one particular form, one particular expression of undefined meaning, that is to say, myth. So I looked up symbol as well. Again, the dictionary wasn't much good. In the English dictionary, the words sign and symbol are virtually synonymous. All the definitions for symbol were derivatives of the word symbol itself, and they're defined by using that term. So it's like you don't actually get a real sense of it. A sign is quite easy. A sign points somewhere, so like Manchester 50 miles. You look at the sign, you see where it's pointing, and you go that way. You don't sort of consider the sign, do you? Deep meanings of this thing. You don't do that. It's a sign. So you just go where it points. That's quite easy. We begin to get somewhere near what symbol means when we look up symbolism in the dictionary, because it says it's a movement in art and literature using symbols to express abstract and mystical ideas. Yeah, we're beginning to get somewhere with it. Jung wouldn't define the term, but used lots of examples, and he pointed the meaning from all sorts of different directions. In Man and His Symbols, he says, what we call a symbol is a term, a name, or even a picture that may be familiar in daily life, yet that possesses specific connotations in addition to its conventional and obvious meaning. It implies something vague, unknown, or hidden from us. So, you know, the meaning of the symbol isn't necessarily particularly obvious immediately. So a word, an image, is symbolic when it implies something more than its obvious and immediate meaning. He also says it has a wider unconscious aspect that is never precisely defined or fully explained, nor can we hope to define or explain it. As the mind explores the symbol, it's led to ideas that lie beyond the grasp of reason. Very good, very good. Now, where do I do that other bit? Maybe I'll pass it. Maybe I'll put it in here. Jung's very good on concepts as well. I'm sure I touch on this again, but I'll mention it here. Because concepts, you can't tie symbols and myths down with concepts. That can't be done. And Jung comes out with this lovely little quote. I've got the reference for it somewhere, but he says, "No one has any obligations to a concept. That is what's so agreeable about conceptuality. It promises protection from experience." So as soon as you start to conceptualize, you lose experience. You lose what you're actually feeling and experiencing. And that's quite important. "The spirit does not dwell in concepts, but in deeds and in facts." That's Jung again. So I really like that. That's quite interesting, because you can get, you can get sort of conceptual about this thing. I've got a quote by Rollo May. I won't bother with that. I've got one by Paul Tillich, but I won't bother with that. Let's get back to Bante. Bante. "It's better not to think of symbols as symbolizing something. Treat them like dreams, to be interpreted loosely in many ways. The more interpretations, the better. When one uses symbolic language, one must be prepared for a certain amount of ambiguity. There isn't one single consistent cut and dried meaning running through all contexts." So it's loose. Symbols are loose. Yeah. This is a little exercise that Bante suggests we try. This is, you'll find this in the seminar transcript somewhere. I can remember him talking about this. That's why I noted it down. So when we think something's a symbol, we can ask ourselves, what do I experience when I look at it? What can it mean? What extra quality does it have? What makes it a symbol? For example, the lotus flower is a symbol. What does it mean? Does it convey something beyond its botanical parameters? I like the way Bante puts things sometimes. What extra quality does it have? What makes it a symbol? Are we investing the innocent lotus with qualities it does not have? Or are we seeing something that is there, but that we don't normally see? What do we feel when we see a lotus? What's the effect that it has on us in terms of feelings and emotions as a subject? What is the objective value of that effect? And then he says, and I put this in bold, "One will generally have to keep this question open because it's a matter of becoming more self-conscious, and there is always room for self-improvement." Wonderful. The lotus doesn't stand for something else. We see it in a deeper and truer way, as illumined by a higher level of significance. When something is a symbol, it will communicate significance. From the standpoint of reality, all things are significant, are symbolical. In Buddhism in general, and in Buddhist Tantra in particular, everything is replete with meaning and significance. Ultimately, there's no difference in significance, though we may experience differences in degree of significance. Anything in the material world can be invested with what makes it a symbol, can be invested with significance. A human being is a symbol. A Buddha is a symbol. Words and concepts are symbols. But both are reified to such an extent that we don't experience them as symbolic or significant at all. They are like subsidiary symbols that we use to describe symbols, though we're unaware of this most of the time because it's automatic. Now, I've told you what a concept was, so that's where this should have fitted in. We can notice the beginnings of the recognition process in and after meditation. After a good meditation, one experiences a state of mind where things seem more significant. Not that that significance is reducible to concepts. It's an experience, isn't it? It's a feeling. This effect is magnified still further when one goes on retreat. And again, maybe here, you know, our significance of things is beginning to get a bit rubbery. And, you know, we came in nice and conceptual and everything was nice and fixed and in place. And now it's all getting rubbery and we're not quite so sure. And that's good, yeah? So we could see the spiritual life in terms of trying to see significance in everything, more and more, all the time. This is another little example from Banti, again, one that I really like. He's quoting Keats. He said, to begin with, Keats wrote, "A thing of beauty is a constant joy." But then later he changed it to, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever." Does one sentence have more resonance than the other? It's interesting, isn't it? A thing of beauty is a constant joy. A thing of beauty is a joy forever. There's more life in that, isn't there? Well, at least for me. So Banti again. What I'm trying to point out is that ordinary life as we live it from day to day is much richer and more complex than we generally realise. And that the account we give of it in words and images for the benefit of others represents an impoverished, not to say misleading, abstraction from the multifaceted, multidimensional totality of our experience. Even the fullest and frankest autobiography is no more than a thin cross-section. Back to, what was his name? Who? J.B. Priestley, that's right. Yeah, a thin cross-section. A narrow segment of the whole, which is the man himself, as, for a certain length of time, he moves about in space and wakes and sleeps and dreams. So, again, this was mentioned the other day, the faculty for apprehending symbols, for experiencing significance or resonance, is the imagination, the imaginal faculty. And again, you can research this, particularly through Banti's tape lectures. To develop this faculty, we need to engage with, and he lists off a number of things, art, looking, yes, do look, but actually try painting, do some, and see what it feels like, yeah? And when you look at art, you know, it's like, don't try and do it with your brain, try and see what it does to your belly, so to speak. Something that comes to mind, years ago, when I was a Mitra convener, I was on this Mitra conveners meeting in West London, and Ratnaguna took myself and this other order member who's since resigned. He said, "Come on, we'll go to the National Gallery and we'll look at some modern art." So we nudged, "Oh, modern art, woo-hoo, you know, a load of rubbish," kind of thing. So he took us into the National Gallery. He said, "We'll go to the Rothko room." So we went into this Rothko room and sort of just big paintings with strips of colour, nothing else. That's all. We sort of looked around. He said, no, sit down and look at the thing. Don't move, just sit and look and see what you feel. So we sat there for a while and we sat there for a bit longer. And I started to feel a bit ill, actually. I started to feel sick. And then suddenly the door burst open and these two tutors came in with loads of students. And they said, "Right, this is the work of Rothko," kind of thing. So they'll go around, they look at the things, they write their notes, you know, they read the titles and look at the painting, yeah, this one, yeah. And so Ratnaguna went up to these teachers and he said, "You're on a hard job here, aren't you?" And they said, "Yeah." He said, we can't get them to sit still long enough to look at the things to actually get some sort of experience. They wouldn't do that. They were all sort of early teenagers, 13, 14 kind of thing. But it was a real lesson. You know, just watching these kids, you know, like after they'd been in there 3 minutes, they wanted to go on to the next one. They were bored, basically. They hadn't actually looked or experienced anything. Very interesting. So art, yeah. Poetry, read it, write it, compose poems, nature, get into nature. Hridayamani's got this lovely book that's very good. It's all about tuning into nature. You might have noticed it while you're here, that nature comes one step forwards when you're out in the country. And And you've got more space. And that's the beauty of going to Guhyaloka. I can't plug Guhyaloka enough. 4 months in this valley with almost no mod cons. And nature is like this, yeah? You can't get away from it. And it has a really strong effect on you. It teases things out of you. It can't be missed. I mean, you could do a month, but a month opposed to 4 months is it's a bit of a weak... of a sort of weak option, really. Do 4 months. Dreams. Ask for dreams. Yeah, this works. Get a pencil and a pad. Put them by it next to your bed. Lie down. Turn the light off and say, "Can I have a dream, please?" And then go to sleep. It works. It really works. And when you wake from the dream, turn the light on and write a few notes immediately. And the more you do that, the more they come. It's like your unconscious wants to talk to you. It's got its own language, so you have to, takes a long time to learn that. But it wants to communicate. But most of the time we're too busy because we think we divide life in half. There's the waking bit and the sleeping bit. And it's not as clear as that. Yeah. Read legends, fairy stories, mythology. See action 26, excuse me. yes, right, yes. And there was another bit. Oh, where's the other bit gone? Myths, fairy tales, fairy stories. The Greeks, read the Greeks. Read the Bible, yeah? The Bible is interesting mythology, yeah? Read Joseph Campbell, James Hillman, Thomas More, Jung, yeah? Read all these people. They've got a lot to say about this sort of stuff. There's a little, because I collect axioms, there's a little, what am I doing for? Oh my God. There's a little axiom that I picked up from a newspaper in, must have been, 2011. I don't know this person, but she said, as the reading self changes, so does the book. Yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't have thought any of this except that, you know, I've done the survey, the 10 pillars, the spiritual friendship, all these results. I've done them about 30 times each. But every time I do them, something new comes out. The last time I did it, it changed me. So the new me reads it again and something else comes out. And that keeps happening. So in a way, you can't do enough of that. I wrote at the time, it strikes me that this is true, just as true for the self that meditates or practices yoga or engages in any of our practices. Those practices change, grow and refine in our experience as we ourselves continue to grow and refine through the practice and the repetition. And then remember the Dhammapada. Non-repetition is the stain of the orally transmitted sacred verses. Yeah? This is from the Dhammapada. Yeah? Repeat things over and over again, especially if they've got meaning. They bear repetition. Where on earth am I now? Oh, yes, right. Da-da-da. Engage in ritual. And all the time interpreting loosely, wondering, standing under, making all sorts of interpretations, but keep them fluid, as well as continually deepening our awareness of self, others, and the world around us. We need to keep asking ourselves, and again through time, what do I experience when I contemplate this symbol, this figure, this image, this poem, these words, this natural phenomena, this dream or dream image, this story, this film, this play, these actions? What's the emotional response? What's the attraction? What's the repulsion? What is it? How does it move me? What else can it mean? What extra quality does it have? What makes it symbolic? What significance does it convey to me? And again, as I say, this is going to change. It will keep changing and deepening and growing. Have the answers to these questions changed from week to week, from year to year? Question mark. How have they changed? Keep reassessing. Keep the reading self-changing. Yeah, the more interpretations, the better. There are many levels of interpretation, many shades of meaning. We must beware the premature synthesis. In fact, never make a final synthesis at all. Everything is in process, yeah? Everything is in process. Oh yeah, well, I'll add this. I hope this isn't a disappointment to anyone, because the work of integration of oneself in all one's heights and depths is in fact a lifetime's work. It's not like doing a 3-year sort of, you know, university course. I've done that, you know, Mitra study, done that. When I was a Mitra study leader in Brighton, I was appalled. I mean, this is long before I'd sort of started looking at this stuff, but I was appalled by, we got to the end of the, what was then the 3-year Mitra study course. And I said, oh, well, we can do it again. No, we've done it. We're not doing that again. They're all older members now. You keep your fingers crossed, you know. So all this stuff, it's not something that you do once and you get out the way, yeah? And then you get on with what you really think you want to do with your life, yeah? You need to make sure that this is what you want to do with your life. Otherwise, you could end up in all sorts of messes. Our lives are processes driven by forces we are largely unaware of. And they already have a tremendous momentum of their own. That's why we can get bogged down in all sorts of social and family situations. And we sort of look around when we're 30 and we think, hey, I get into this, what happened? But you're fixed, yeah? Or to get out actually takes a lot of effort. We must engage with this process of learning the symbolic language of our own individual imaginal faculty, if only to gain a measure of emotional maturity and truly human status. Never mind spiritual maturity, yeah? I'm talking about emotional maturity and actually being a human being. Because that's, you know, if you look at Bhante's, you know, hierarchy, yeah? Human being is quite a long way up there, yeah? I always remember this line from... what are they called? They wrote loads of popular operas.
Gilbert and Sullivan.
Gilbert and Sullivan, that's it. What is it? Darwinian man, though well behaved, is scarcely more than a monkey, shaved. I really like that. That's what we're like. We're shaved monkeys. Well, I'm not shaved, but... Telling your life story will get you in touch with it as well. Aloka, the master of myth. I can remember on one of these retreats, somebody said to me, oh, I'm still waiting for my myth to arise. So Aloka said, well, don't wait too long. You're already living a myth. Make sure it's positive and creative and not mundane and superficial. So you have to look at what you're doing now. That's a myth. Is it mundane and useless, or is it meaningful and purposeful? Interesting question. Oh, and I'll throw this. I don't know whether this is supposed to come in here. I can't remember where I'm supposed to put this. But this is a little axiom that I picked up quite a long time ago. And this isn't a comment. I'm not trying to have a go at people with families or anything like that. This is my way of looking at things. Maybe I'll say a little bit about that in a minute. Personal myth. This is Farid ud-Din Attar. I'd rather die deceived by dreams than give my heart to home and trade and never live. When I read that, it was like a thunderbolt. Right, okay. Now, I suppose the reason, if I get onto my own personal stuff, a bit about personal myth, I covered quite a lot. How am I doing for time? There's a little bit of time there. Pardon?
We've got all night.
So personal myths. When I was very young, I was really interested in war, especially the Second World War. I couldn't get enough of it. Films, books, magazines and all the rest of it. No, I had no sort of imagination. You know, I couldn't imagine the pain that people went through or the sort of psychological trauma involved in engaging in all that stuff. But when I started to think about it, I think what it was that my life was a battle. I was having a battle with my mum, basically. And it's interesting. I mean, that's why I come out with that thing. Because I knew by the time I was 8, watching my parents perform with each other, I thought, there's got to be a better way than this. You know, they're not making much of a job of this marriage. And when I got to 12, I told them I thought they ought to divorce. And they were really shocked. They didn't. But I think that's largely because my dad was extremely loyal and good-natured and easygoing. So he put up with a lot. But I think that's why I started off being very interested in war. a bit after that... This is sort of going a bit deeper. I got very interested in cowboys and Indians. And the characters I liked were like the Indian scout, you know. So he's a white American, but he's on the frontier. He's on the border. He can talk to the Native Americans. He knows their languages. He knows how they behave. And they sort of trust him and he sort of trusts them. So he's an intermediary. And there was something about that I really liked. I think being between two cultures and being on the edge as well, something about that, being on the frontier, on the border. Bit later on again, I got a bicycle and that was it. I got out of home. You know, I cycled to my freedom, basically. I became a cycling nut just to get out the way. It's interesting, though, when you look back. I mean, I think as well I was lucky in that I seemed to see the gaps in life and the gaps in sort of, you know, the concepts and what the newspapers were telling me and what my teachers were telling me. You know, they give me a story and I think, no, but there's a hole there and there's a hole there and these bits don't fit together. And I seem to sort of know that from quite an early age. I mean, I don't quite know where I got that from. I knew I wasn't getting the full picture. I really knew I wasn't getting the full picture. So I wasn't interested in... I knew by the time I was like 19 or 20, I didn't want a family and I didn't want a career. But I didn't know what the hell I was going to do with myself. I really didn't. Until... Well, first of all, I belonged to an order. I joined the International Order of Kabbalists. But that was extremely conceptual. It was very, very intellectual. And I certainly didn't, you know, I didn't have much of an intellect. So I was always sort of hanging on by the skin of my teeth to what they were saying. And then I came across Bante, basically. Well, I met Subhuti, really. And I just thought, whatever this man's into, I want what he's got. He was friendly. He seemed to be, he seemed to know where he was going. He had meaning and purpose, and that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted. Where are we? I've got much else to say. I could say stuff about the struggle for meaning. I mean, as I say, for me it sort of came naturally, but maybe for some of you it doesn't. I knew there had to be some sort of meaning to life. I wasn't just here to sort of bumble along and fall into whatever my parents did. I didn't want to do that. I was quite determined not to do that. And I've got quotes that I could give you, but done all that. Yeah. I've got. This is interesting. I'll read you. This is Rumi. This is a sort of precept, really, along with axioms. I like to collect precepts, personal precepts for myself. And this is one. This is Rumi, and it's called Be Suspicious of Yourself. Everything you do has a quality which comes back to you in some way. Every action takes a form in the invisible world, which may be different from how you thought it would appear. A crime is committed, and a gallows begins to be built. One does not look like the other, but they correspond. Accept the results of what you've done in anger or for greed or to elevate your ego. Don't blame fate, That's a dog who lies in the kennel and will not respond to anybody's calling. Be suspicious of yourself. Inquire about your hidden motives. It takes courage to repent and more courage to change. But realize this, just as dust grains shine in sunlight coming through the window, so there's a light of reality within which ideas, hidden hypocrisies, and the qualities of every action become clear. All you've done and will do will be seen in the light of that sun. I like that. We're getting near the end, I think. You'll be pleased to know. No, they don't fit in really anymore. No, that doesn't fit in. Was there anything else? Oh, I was gonna tell you a couple of little stories from the early days. I mean, I don't know whether this is even before your time. The very early Mythic Context retreats. Arloka, as I said, is the master of myth. And that became obvious the first time we did a Mythic Context retreat. So Subhuti just handed the whole thing over to him. So one time, on one retreat, he said, right, clear out the shrine room. That was when the dining room was the shrine room. He said, clear that out. So we cleared it out. Put down two big sheets of plastic and wheelbarrowed in a great heap of earth. I mean, it must have been about 10, 12 feet in diameter, and it came up to about there, just this pile of soil in the middle of the room. And then the first night we all sat around it, he said, right, this is our focus. We're going to turn this into something that has meaning for us, something that we love, that we want, all that kind of stuff. And that's what we did over 2 weeks. We painted pictures, we hung seed syllables on it, we put candles on it and flowers. It was quite amazing just watching this thing grow, get bigger and bigger and bigger. And everybody was completely riveted. And we sat all the way around as well. So it was very sort of, because we usually, it's in one place, isn't it? But we were all around it. It was quite magical. What else did he do? The pile of soil. Oh, there was another one where... I think this was more Subhuti's idea, but everybody came along. And so we said, we said to the mitras, okay, you make the program. You know, so tomorrow we won't do anything. You'll just spend the day working out the program and then you'll tell us what it is and then we'll do it kind of thing. So by about, middle of the afternoon, they came up with this program. So Subhuti looked at it and said, no, that's what we always do. We're not doing that. Go back and do it again. So they had to go and find another program that wasn't the one that they usually did, which they managed to do in the end. But then these free-form sort of mythic contexts started to get a bit... Word got out and, you'd be asked to give a little talk on your favourite figure on the refuge tree. So people started coming along with them already prepared, which is like, completely misses the point. Don't know if I've got any more thoughts about the early days. Maybe that's nearly it. Oh yeah, I thought I'd read you this as my finishing piece. This is George Bernard Shaw, would you believe? And I sort of put it with Rumi's, Jalaluddin, what's his name? Who? That's it, yeah. I'd rather live by, deceived by dreams. So this goes with that, yeah. So this is from Man and Superman, apparently, by George Bernard Shaw. This is the true joy in life. The being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one. The being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I'm of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and as long as I live, it's my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die. For the harder I work, the more I live. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is no brief candle for me. It's a sort of splendid torch which I've got hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations.